First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
The Biden administration sends critical PPE to the First Coast as local hospitals fight to save unvaccinated patients. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for listening to First Coast Connect today. Just ahead, we'll tell you why strained to the limit hospitals right here in our area are getting ventilators supplied by the federal government to help COVID patients now overrunning ICUs across North Florida. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, UNF faculty are rallying today, calling for stronger safety measures on their campus. But first this morning, the federal government is sending hundreds of ventilators to Florida to deal with the COVID crisis. The Biden administration says it sent the ventilators down here at the request of Florida hospitals who are currently overrun with COVID patients. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis appeared to be caught flat-footed when he was asked about the ventilator deliveries, saying he didn't know about them.
I did not know about that. So I've not heard about that. So I have to check to see whether that's true or not. I would honestly doubt that that's true, but I'll look.
However, hospitals in our area confirm it is true. Baptist Health has requested dozens of ventilators, which are used for the most seriously ill COVID patients. Flagler Hospital has received 24 new ventilators. And we want to touch base with Flagler Hospital executives right now as we welcome Dr. David Rice, Chief Physician Executive at Flagler Health. He's on the line. Dr. Rice, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Melissa. Pleasure to be here.
And as we talk about the crisis in area hospitals who are racing to try to save mostly unvaccinated patients from COVID and the delivery of ventilators from the White House, give us a call, 549-2937, emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. Dr. Rice, what's the situation right now at Flagler Hospital in the COVID ward or wards?
Sure. So obviously, like most hospitals in the region, we've seen a significant increase in COVID cases. Less than 50% of our census right now would be COVID patients. So we're doing well, flexing where we need to. We have plenty of resources. The ventilators really help. The staff morale is outstanding. So we're in good shape and looking forward to getting past this. And in the meantime, of course, we're here for the community.
Sure. Can you explain a little bit about why these ventilators are so important and how they assist doctors and nurses caring for a COVID patient, and why it's serious when you need more ventilators?
Sure. Well, I think that most of the listeners know that ventilators help people breathe. These are what people might refer to as breathing machines. COVID is predominantly, not entirely, but predominantly a respiratory illness. And so patients that are severely ill with COVID end up consuming a lot of oxygen for support. And some of those patients will progress to needing that breathing machine or ventilatory support. And so it's critical in those patients that are more significantly or seriously ill.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that once a patient goes on a ventilator, hopes are fading for that patient to survive, or is that more of an urban legend?
I think it's an urban legend that was born out of early experience. I think we've learned a lot in a very short period of time, and we have treatments now that are available that weren't available initially. We have people that are vaccinated and hopefully avoiding ventilators altogether. And then how we manage people even on ventilators has changed during the pandemic. And so it's a different situation today than it was a year and a half ago when all of this began.
As we speak with Dr. David Rice, Chief Physician Executive at Flagler Health, Florida has yet again broken a new case record. The state reported 24,753 new COVID cases Tuesday to the CDC. Florida makes up about 6% of the U.S. population, but we've got nearly 20% of the COVID cases. Doctor, that is attributed primarily to the unvaccinated. And is that what you are seeing at Flagler Health, that it is mostly unvaccinated people coming into your ICU?
Yes, not entirely, but mostly. The vaccines absolutely are tremendously helpful. They have saved countless lives in regards to this. Approximately 80%+ of the patients that are admitted to the hospital are unvaccinated patients with COVID.
So, of course, we say this every day on this show. You want to get the message out, too. Please get vaccinated. That would make it a lot easier on health systems like yours, because this crush of COVID patients is affecting other areas of your operations, isn't it? ER visits and surgeries for other types of ailments.
Absolutely. This impacts all aspects of healthcare, and nobody's been left unimpacted by this pandemic. The vaccines save lives. There's no doubt about that. I will tell you that, you know, when these vaccines first came out, they were studied in 30,000+ patients for each vaccine. And even as a healthcare provider, it was my job not just to take that information, but to really look at it and dissect it. And I came away with the conclusion that these vaccines are incredible. Now we've given, 4 billion doses worldwide? There's tremendous amount of data out there that shows how safe these vaccines are, how effective they are. They're one of the most effective vaccines that we have in our resources today. And so thrilled that the rates are going up. Would love to see them continue to go up. I've been vaccinated. Family's been vaccinated. So I'm not just a supporter. I'm doing it personally as well.
Sure. And of course, for parents of kids under 12 who aren't yet eligible to be vaccinated, they're very worried about the start of school in Florida. How many pediatric patients are you seeing in your region? Of course, Wilson Children's Hospital in Jacksonville is giving us a daily tally, and they are admitting patients, minors, with serious COVID. What's it like in your neck of the woods?
Obviously, far fewer cases in the pediatric population, and I think that Wolfson and Baptist will tell you the same as far as their admissions with the volume and census they have, and my vast minority of those are pediatric patients. And so what we see majority of the time are adults and those with comorbidities and those the elderly that aren't vaccinated are at the highest risk right now for developing COVID and requiring hospitalization or even ICU care because of COVID.
We're speaking with Dr. David Rice, Chief Physician Executive at Flagler Health. Flagler, along with Baptist Health, other hospitals around Florida, they are taking delivery of new ventilators sent by the Biden administration to deal with serious COVID cases. Give us a call, 549-2937, Bill in Mandarin. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. Two questions, and maybe a good doctor can answer it. Has there been any demographic assessment among the resistors? My inclination is the redneck kind of guy. I'd be entirely wrong. But the other one is, what's been the cost to both the state and the federal government to have to take care of these people on insurance, whether if private insurance does not? Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, the cost of this pandemic to the healthcare system, doctor.
Tremendous burden, tremendous cost for the healthcare system as a whole nationally. The government has stepped in to do some things early on to help mitigate that. I cannot give you specific numbers in regards to the cost of this, but I think we all realize that it's significant.
Yeah, I mean, and can I ask you as a follow-up, if a patient is in the ICU for a number of weeks with COVID-19, even if they have health insurance, they are going to be paying a lot of money for that treatment. We are seeing people set up GoFundMe accounts to try to pay for these medical bills. The ICU care is expensive. Tell us about that.
Well, sure. I mean, a lot of ICU care requires just dedicated nursing, dedicated resources, a high volume of resources. And so obviously the cost of that is significant. Regarding specific patients, there's so many variables that go into that regarding the insurer and co-pays and things that I certainly can't answer the specifics of that. But yes, ICU care requires a lot of resources, and these patients really need those resources to provide them the best opportunity to recover.
Yeah. And so you can either take a chance of paying tens of thousands of dollars if you end up in the ICU, or you can get a vaccine that's free, doctor. You know, to me, it seems like a simple decision, but it's really been frustrating to see how many people continue to refuse the vaccine. And then we later hear in some cases of these same folks getting sick. It's heartbreaking.
It is heartbreaking. No one likes to see that. In regards to, I don't think that the finances are what are driving people not to get vaccinated. I think that politics may have played a role in that. And I think that any time we're talking about these vaccines, I'd like to pull the politics out. Let's just look at the science and where we are. And I think when the FDA comes by and they look at this and they've got formal approval that will come out shortly, you're going to see the safety profile of this and be very impressed with it. And you're going to see the efficacy of the vaccine and be very impressed with that as well.
549-2937, Jerry in St. Augustine. Hi, Jerry. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. My question is for the doctor. Does Flagler please?
Yeah, we're having trouble hearing you, Jerry. Can you speak in right into your phone?
Yes.
There you go.
Can you hear me
now?
Yeah,
go ahead.
Okay. Does Flagler Health mandate employees and healthcare workers to get the vaccine? I understand that Mayo and Baptist and St. Vincent are doing that. And if Flagler is not, I would like to know what the reasons are. Thank you.
Sure. Dr. Rice, will you be requiring your staff to get vaccinated?
Jerry, great question. Seems to be a very popular one these days. At this point in time, Flagler has not decided to move towards mandatory vaccinations. And there's a lot that goes into play here. And the three health systems that you mentioned were in Duval County. Obviously, we're in St. Johns County with a slightly different situation down here. First and foremost, many of our team members have already been vaccinated. We're looking at 72-73% of our team members and affiliated physicians that have received the vaccine. Our rate of positivity was not what it was in Duval County, and so it's a little bit of a different situation on the ground. More people in St. Johns County, more of the community has been vaccinated, including people over and under the age of 65 than compared to Duval County. Mm-hmm. And so we're in a little bit different situation, and we need to look at our situation with our team members and what might be best for them and the community when we make those decisions. The emergency use authorization still exists as far as the FDA is concerned. I think obviously once that's removed, it'll be an interesting conversation across the country, maybe even more of an interesting conversation across the country. And we continue to discuss these things internally every other day. And so we're on top of it. We're evaluating the situation, and we will continue to do so.
So by that, are you perhaps projecting that once the emergency use authorization is removed, you would require your staff to get the COVID vaccine?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I am saying, though, is we will continue to discuss this with community leaders. We will continue to discuss this with our team members and our clinical staff to come up with the best decision for this community and for Flagler Health.
Okay, 549-2937, Cynthia in Riverside. Hi, Cynthia. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. This is just such a horrific thing that is happening, especially in Florida. We should be ashamed, and I just don't understand why people aren't beating at the door of the governor's office. He has so many dead bodies on his hands for his choice of trying to use this as a platform for a presidential race. I just cannot fathom somebody being this cruel. And all the resources that are being used on Facebook last week, there was somebody trying to get their husband to Tennessee for an ECMO machine. This is a family with two young children. If he would have just gotten the shot, you know, I don't want to say anything bad about this man, but if he just would have gotten the shot, he wouldn't have been in this situation. I think it's a very selfish decision not to take this shot.
Cynthia, thanks. Okay, doctor, let me ask you about this, because certainly people were surprised to see the governor wasn't even aware that Florida health systems were requiring ventilators or asking the federal government for ventilators. We have emails about that from listeners. What is the protocol for a hospital like Flagler when you are trying to get this sort of PPE? Tell us how that all came together.
Well, PPE, the protective equipment, looked at a little bit differently than the ventilators, but like any health system, we would go through our vendors first and foremost. And so every health system has vendors they utilize to help supply with supplies and the like. And so we go with them, and then we also would escalate up to the governor's office. Something like this would push us to escalate up to the governor's office and state level and asking for assistance in regards to the ventilators.
And then, so I'm looking at the statement from Flagler Health that you are continuing to see an increasing volume of patients requiring ventilation support. So what about this then that the White House said we sent ventilators to Florida because they're needed? The governor said I wasn't aware of that. How did the chain get lost there?
Not sure. We work through our local and state governments, and I got to tell you, I mean, this is, I don't want to get into the politics of this. So I really prefer the science, but I would tell you, I've been impressed with how responsive they were with the ventilators and delivering them. We're very thankful for that. We worked very well with our local and state governments and just glad that they showed up so quickly.
Peter on the South Side. Hi, Peter. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning. We keep dancing around this topic every day, but one of the real issues is when is the FDA going to give formal approval, not emergency approval, but formal approval to the vaccines? That will remove a lot of the excuses that people are making, and then we'll see what the real reason is they're not taking the vaccine.
Thanks, Peter. Doctor, I know that's a date on the calendar a lot of people are looking forward to.
I would say all of us are looking forward to it, yeah. For sure, Peter. I would say two things are going to come out in the next couple months. One would be a recommendation for the FDA in regards to potential boosters for immunocompromised patients, and we need to take that seriously. And then secondly will be this full approval of the vaccine. Pfizer will come first in that, hopefully followed by Moderna at some point here. You asked when. I don't have a crystal ball. Don't have definitive answer there. What I'm hearing is sometime in possibly even late September or early October, we may have that full approval. But once again, that is just a very fluid date, and it's my date. It's not a date provided to us by the FDA, the CDC, or anything else. That's me looking at where we stand, talking to experts in the field, and getting opinions.
549-2937, lots of calls as we speak with Dr. David Rice, Chief Physician Executive at Flagler Health. James and Jax. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning for the good doctor there. I've got a question, not picking on any demographic group, and I do watch some Latino TV, but I noticed that the government is really pursuing hard the vaccination of, women that are trying to get pregnant or that want to get pregnant or that are thinking about it, because I'm just trying to keep the politics out of this. So because me and my wife are sitting here watching this, and we're like, she said, that makes a lot of sense to me. Women, worried about the reproductive, issues and things like that. So, aside from that, me and my wife, we got vaccinated and everything. But we've noticed that people we talk to, like, for example, mom and dad were vaccinated, but then the four children aren't vaccinated because they're under 12. And
yeah.
That could be a problem. COVID, correct?
Yeah. And James, thank you for that. I'm so glad you brought that up because, of course, this week in St. John's County, the school board had a marathon meeting over 6 hours of public comment, some crazy amount of time. And at the end of it, they decided not to do a mass mandate. That has been a matter of great concern for St. John's County parents with kids under the age of 12. We spoke with one parent who was at that meeting and told us she will be putting her kids in virtual school this year because they are under 12 and she's concerned about this. Take a listen.
They are saying that they're handcuffed by the governor, so they're not going to make any changes based on the executive order. I think it's unfortunate, and I think that they really need to stand up for themselves and make the right decision, not the easy decision. And I don't think it's right for people who say, well, your kid, if your kid wants to wear a mask, then they should stay home. Well, no. My kids put their my three kids put their time in last year, and they all did virtual school. And now, you know, with COVID being even worse than last year, they're removing these safeguards. How is that supposed to, you know, help me or help my children?
Okay, doctor, what about this? You're in St. John's County. There's the school district there. Unlike Duval County and some other more urban districts around the state, St. John's is not doing a mask mandate in schools. What are your concerns about how that might affect public health in your county?
Well, I think anytime we get together, there's that risk with COVID. I think the reality is they've left that decision up to the parents and the families, and I would recommend that those parents do decide for their children to wear masks if unvaccinated, especially. It makes sense to me, but don't want to get into the politics of what the decisions have been from governor's office or local governments and the like. From a scientific perspective, the CDC does recommend masking, and therefore I will follow that recommendation.
And, you know, it's something that I know you want to avoid political discussion, but I would think certainly for any healthcare professional right now, this has got to be frustrating. What's it been like for you and your staff dealing with this? Because we do have a lot of misinformation about masks and vaccines out there, and it is prolonging this pandemic for all of us.
I agree. I will tell you that the staff has been working hard. What I generally have told people is I see staff working. It's a marathon. We're working at a sprint pace right now. So that obviously can tire out a staff over time. That's why we're all very much in favor of vaccines. And I will tell you that the way to get through this is to vaccinate as many of the population as possible. So I wouldn't say necessarily that the staff is frustrated. The entire staff. I think that, you know, these people come to work and do this day in and day out. They take care of patients. That's what they've done their entire lives. And so to them, they're taking care of COVID patients now, and we want to get rid of this COVID because of the mortalities and all associated with it. But these professionals, this is what they do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, are you concerned at all about the strain on your doctors and nurses, the mental health toll this takes on healthcare workers?
Absolutely. I think we need to be very cognizant of that. I think we need to address it, but this is more than just a healthcare issue. I think that we've seen nationally rates of depression and anxiety during the pandemic increase significantly, and isolation has probably contributed to that, although it's been necessary to save lives too. And so it's the push and the pull of that. So mental health is a much bigger issue beyond COVID, but it's a national issue that we need to address, and would love for us to do that at a more significant level.
Flagler Hospital reporting, as we mentioned earlier, a record number of 122, actually it's over 130 now, COVID patients as of Tuesday. And to help meet the demand for testing in St. John's County, Flagler Health and the City of St. Augustine are opening up a new testing site. Can you talk about the importance of testing?
Absolutely. Testing is critical. If you are symptomatic, we would like to see you get tested so that you know whether you need to isolate or not. If someone gets infected with COVID, we want to make sure that they're not spreading that around to others. And so it's also, although I kind of look at it as our personal decision but obligation to vaccinate, and if you're symptomatic, I would look at this as the same. Get tested so you know and so that you're being safe with those around you.
Please do that. Please get vaccinated too, and please mask up. And I want to thank you, Dr. David Rice, Chief Physician Executive at Flagler Health, on the line. Thanks so much for all you're doing.
Thank you so much.
Much more still ahead. Later, how Feeding Northeast Florida is helping food insecure families as kids head back to class hungry. But up next.
We think it's a step in the right direction. We hope that the pressure that we've been putting on administration has resulted in this shift.
UNF faculty rally on campus calling for a mask mandate. That's next.
The Jacksonville area is home to two Navy bases, a Coast Guard headquarters, and a major National Guard base. It's an important city when it comes to national security. Join the American Security Project at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, August 24th, in partnership with ADAPT, to learn about how our region's military installations are rising to meet the threat of climate change. Reserve your ticket now at wjct.org/events.
Hi, this is WJCT News Engagement Editor Sydney Bowles. This fall, we'll be launching a newsletter bringing the top stories from our region right to your inbox. And we want to make it something you're excited about. Share your thoughts now at wjct.org/survey. It's short, and it'll help us make sure we're serving you best. One more time, that's wjct.org/survey. Thanks!
Northeast Florida artists are making noise that's reverberating across the country, and the Jacksonville Music Experience is your ticket to the local scene. Music reviews, curated playlists, music history, concert recommendations, and profiles of local artists, all put together by our team of local contributors. The Jacksonville Music Experience plays it local and plays it loud. Visit jacksmusic.org to read and hear more.
Welcome back. UNF faculty are rallying outside this morning's Board of Trustees meeting on campus, calling for stronger safety protocols as the fall term begins. Masks are expected to be worn at UNF, but they are not mandated. I spoke with Faculty Union President Nicholas DeVilliers. Nicholas, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
So what is the faculty's position on this latest announcement from UNF saying that masks won't be mandated on campus, but expected?
Mm-hmm. So we think it's a step in the right direction, and we hope that the pressure that we've been putting on administration has resulted in this shift. UNF is also following the model and specifically the language of UF and USF, where they're sort of finding a way to say we expect it, but of course we can't mandate it. In part because people are worried about angering the governor. So it's a step in the right direction, and it moves us closer to the CDC guidelines for institutions of higher education, which the original Board of Governors reopening plan, which said no masks, we're back to normal, I think that really kind of took us too far away from the CDC guidelines.
So the UNF Board of Trustees is meeting. You yeah. will be on hand to make your voice heard. What will you be asking them to do?
So I'm probably going to be presenting the statement from the petition, the Keep Our UNF Community Safe petition, which now has 270 signatures, which is addressed directly to the Board of Trustees. And our goal is there's a bit of a vacuum of leadership right now because President Szymanski is stepping into a new position, and they're going to be considering at this Board of Trustees meeting the interim president. And so we really want to just talk to them about faculty's concerns. So we have five different people who are going to be speaking about those concerns that are about health and safety. And we're going to be asking for leadership and also for flexibility. So we're hoping that they will meet us back at the bargaining table to talk about a proposed memorandum of understanding that would give faculty the ability to determine their course modalities. Because up until very recently, we've been told again, we're back to face-to-face and no more modifications can be made, which we're just hoping that they'll acknowledge that, you know, the Board of Governors reopening plan was drafted at a different time before the Delta variant, before Jacksonville became an epicenter of the pandemic. And so we just need to be flexible to adjust if we need to keep people safe.
Okay. So in addition to hopefully mandating masks, which might be a long shot, what are some other safety measures that you as faculty president would like to see on the UNF campus?
So last year, I think that we were really great at UNF at thinking fast and training on remote modalities, so using Zoom and other ways to keep people safe, when the conditions were not as bad as they are right now. So we feel like we're all quite capable, and we just want the flexibility for faculty to be able to request, say, starting remotely if they feel like that's necessary. That may not be the case for everyone, but we just want people to be able to request it if they feel like it would be safer. The other thing that we've been hearing from the administration is that faculty can use the ADA accommodation, so Americans with Disabilities Act. But we feel like it's being used as a kind of hurdle for faculty to clear. And it doesn't accommodate, ADA doesn't accommodate things like concerns for children, for unvaccinated children. A lot of our faculty are concerned about their families or for caretakers, like people are taking care of elderly parents. So we want them to kind of acknowledge that there's concerns that go beyond accommodations made for disabled people, but also, you know, not treating the ADA as a hurdle. I mean, it's the spirit of the ADA is about access and accommodations.
Mm. You know, universities around the country have started mandating vaccinations for students and mm-hmm. faculty. We aren't seeing that yet at public universities in Florida, but certainly you're mm-hmm. watching what's going on in higher ed around the country. What are your thoughts?
So other than envy for the people that I know who teach at those institutions that mm-hmm. do feel comfortable mandating it, I mean, I think that is not our position right now. Right? We're not calling for a vaccine mandate. I think UNF is making some progress by having some incentives for students to get vaccinated, but we are concerned.
Oh yeah, let me just jump in. They're offering $100 to students to get vaccinated,
they
right?
Are.
Yeah.
They are, which is great. And again, we really hope that young people will understand the importance of vaccination. But so right now, we still are seeing the numbers are pretty low in Jacksonville. It's like 50% are vaccinated. And we don't know necessarily, I think, for younger people that maybe even lower than that. So right now, we just want for UNF to follow the CDC guidelines for institutions of higher education with mixed vaccination populations, which best describes our students. And those call for masking and social distancing when possible.
Nicholas DeVilliers, thanks for joining us. He is the UNF president, chapter of the United Faculty of Florida. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Well, more than 76,000 kids are food insecure here in North Florida. That's one in five children who are heading back to school hungry this month. This region's largest nonprofit food bank has a plan, though, to fill in those nutritional gaps for our students. Heather Gassendi is Director of Marketing and Communications for Feeding Northeast Florida, and she's on the line. Hi, Heather.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being with us. So, families and kids are hungry and food insecure year-round, but this time of year is especially challenging. Can you explain why?
Yeah, that's right. You know, with the added back-to-school expenses, before and after-school care, and other increased utility bills, funds are really tight for many families. As such, food is often the first thing to get cut from the budget.
Right. Parents have to make decisions. And often they'll go without food themselves to feed their kids, or if they've got a car accident, they've got to pay for that. They may not have enough money for food. One in five kids in our area is not getting good nutrition or is what you call food insecure. That means that their access to fresh, healthy food is not consistent, correct?
That's correct. So, you know, many of the children that we're serving don't know where their next meal is going to come from. They don't know what their next meal is going to look like. And, you know, what we do here is we, you know, fight hunger year-round, but especially during back to school time and throughout the year, we're able to partner with schools and after school programs across our 8-county service area to provide that food resource for these children.
Yeah, and you're expanding this year, right? You're expanding it.
Yes, we are. We are. One of the great things about this program is that we have such a close-knit relationship with the schools that we serve. And this past year, we really, you know, sat down and we took in the feedback that we were receiving from teachers and administration about how to best serve the children that they teach every day. And from there, we developed a new 3-pronged program. So this program is going to include our traditional snack packs, which are individually packed bags that go home with children on Fridays to provide sustenance over the weekends. About 50% of Duval County Public School students rely on free and reduced lunch during the school week to help them, you know, get by. So these snack packs allow them to have food over the weekend so they don't miss that meal. So in addition to that, we're also doing Fresh Selects, which is a fresh fruit option. Many of the teachers said that this is something that the kids wanted, and we're able to do that. We do get a lot of produce in, and we felt that was an awesome way to connect that. And then Snack Station. So many of the teachers and guidance counselors and administrators were saying is they would take our snack packs and break them down because during the school week, they would have students that would come in and they'd need something to get through the day. So they were kind of making their own little stashes to have, you know, things on hand to provide to these students. So these snack stations will be 40-pound boxes of shelf-stable food that the teachers and administrators can distribute as needed.
This is great because imagine coming to class as a kid hungry. You can't focus. You can't do well in school if you're on an empty stomach all the time. It's just terrible to think that there are that many children, Heather, who are in that situation in our community.
Yeah, it breaks my heart. As a mother of a little one, I just can't imagine that. You know, these children are coming to school and their tummies are rumbling. There's no way that they can focus on the studies that they're learning and even engage with others. No other children. So what we hear from the teachers is these children show up, they're distracted, they might act out, they also ask for water a lot more. They're trying to fill their bellies with water. So this resource really helps the children fill their bellies so that they can open their minds and learn today and succeed tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, as you have talked about a lot, the studies on childhood hunger show kids that are hungry are going to get lower test scores, lower grades. So feeding children it's another way of contributing to economic development, because when you improve a school district's test scores, you improve the neighborhood.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, from the time we're born until we're about in our mid-20s, our brains are not fully developed. So hunger slows down the body's development process, causing you to not reach your full potential, like you mentioned, and has lasting effects on your health as an adult. So, you know, starting at an early age with nutritious food, consistent access to nutritious food is really key in sustaining our community.
And you mentioned the fresh fruit option with Fresh Selects that you're doing at Feeding Northeast Florida. That's important, too, because people might not realize, Heather, how big food deserts are in this community. You can drive miles and miles and miles across parts of Duval County and never see a grocery store offering fresh produce.
That's right. I believe there's about a little over 40 food deserts in Duval County alone. And that's the absence, like you said, of an ability to go somewhere that is within walking distance and get fresh produce, fresh foods on a consistent basis. So it's staggering. So what we do is, you know, being Northeast Florida, we're able to go into these communities. This is separate from our child feeding programs. This is, you know, feeding for health and feeding our communities. But we go in and we hold mobile pantries where we have fresh fruit, fresh vegetables, a high quality protein, dairy products, shelf stable products that we're able to give to these families that are in need, whatever situation they might find themselves in. So that's a really, really great tool. And many of the families we do feed do access this. So that's another way to get healthy food to the children that need it.
We're speaking with Heather Gassendi of Feeding Northeast Florida, the largest nonprofit food bank in the region, serving a multi-county area. As kids head back to school, they are expanding their child feeding program. You know, Heather, people always ask, how can I help with this issue? I used to actually serve on the board of your organization back when it was called Second Harvest. And
that's right.
People can help in a number of ways. You can go volunteer at the food bank. That's one way, right? But the most important thing people can do is cash or check donations. You can take a donation from a listener out there and turn that into a lot of food because of the economy of scale you have. That's a better way to help, isn't it, than people dropping off food?
Yes. I mean, we love food donations, too. That helps us stock empty pantries. But like you mentioned, for every dollar donated, 6 meals can be provided. The child feeding program alone this year, we estimate, will cost about $360,000 to operate. And it's coming out to approximately $150 per child for the entire school year. So if you are able to, we encourage your listeners to donate monetarily, as our organization can stretch donated dollars much further.
You can do that at feedingnefl.org for Feeding Northeast Florida. Check it out online. As kids head back to school, 1 in 5 kids in our area is food insecure. So do what you can to help as Feeding Northeast Florida expands their child feeding program. Heather Gassendi, Director of Marketing and Communications at Feeding Northeast Florida. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Again, that website, feedingnefl.org. And thank you for the emails from Camden County, Georgia, right across the state line, letting us know that free and reduced lunch is expanding in that school district for the school year to help food insecure people in Georgia and kids there. Still to come, artistic leader and performer Barbara Colicello and her new one-woman show, Open Hearted, after this.
Community First Mortgage Champions are committed to offering a great rate, a quick close, and fewer costs at closing. Accepting applications at communityfirstfl.org. Community First Credit Union, federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Ascension St. Vincent's. CARE is listening and delivering personalized plans from a team of specialists dedicated to providing the latest technology and treatment at every step. Information and appointments at getjackshealthcare.com. St. John's County Cultural Events Division presents Sing Out Loud Festival in St. Augustine, September 10th through 26th. Over 100 performances, including TLC, Parquet Courts, YOLA, Patty Griffin, and May Day Parade. Info at singoutloudfestival.com.
To hear what local military installations are doing about climate change, join the American Security Project in partnership with ADAPT for a discussion on Tuesday, August 24th at 10 a.m. Register now at wjct.org/events.
I'm Robin Young. The FDA banned electric shock treatments at a residential school for challenged kids. An appeals court overturned that ban, even though the FDA statement said the treatments can cause
worsening of underlying symptoms, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, pain, burns, and tissue damage.
Next time, here and now.
Today at 2 on WJCT News 89.9.
Summer travel plans are in limbo for millions of people. As checklists grow, more obstacles are being put in the way of you getting to your final destination. Wearing a mask is the easy part, but how safe is it to travel, and what are your best options for a break this summer? Some tips as we answer your questions on the next 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. She is a local artistic leader, and she's out with a provocative new one-woman show. Barbara Colicello and her Babs Lab is debuting a new play, Open Hearted, this Friday at the Cork District. I spoke with her to get a preview. Take a listen. Barbara Colicello, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. How are you?
I'm all right. Hanging in there like we all are. So tell us what you're up to with this new theatrical experience, Open Hearted. It's about you and your heart, but it's about more than that, right?
Right. It begins at a point in time where I was the main caregiver for my mother, who July 9th turned 99.
Wow.
And yeah. And I was also about to launch a Kickstarter for my space called Babs Lab. To raise about $15,000 to upgrade it and get lights and all of that stuff. And I was also raising money to produce Al Letson's anti-bullying play, Chalk. Mm-hmm. And I, like out of nowhere, just luckily, divine intervention, found out that I actually had an aneurysm growing on my thoracic ascending aorta.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, out of nowhere. And so it was dependent on the size of that, when I needed surgery. And so it's just that's where the play starts. This point in time, do I go ahead with the Kickstarter? I may die. when I was looking at the statistics for, what I had and what we had to do, what they had to do. But
right. So this
luckily,
is about
Mayo.
You went to Mayo.
Yeah, well, I researched Mayo is the top hospital for vascular surgery, the kind that I needed. So I was lucky
That's great. I'm glad that you were able to get that. And then in this time when we're all so focused on our health, this is about women's heart health, but caregiving as well. And what it's like to care for yourself and also an aging parent.
Yes, and this is going to be, there's a crisis in caregiving, and there's such a shortage of nursing homes and staff. More and more people, as the population, people live longer, you're going to have younger people who are going to need to take care of their parents. So it's sort of this dance between the balance of trying to take care of yourself and someone else, and we all know that it's difficult already to take care of ourselves in terms of our work, and if we have children and all of that, we really have to be radical. That's where the term now has come from. But when you're also in charge of somebody else and their money situation and their doctor's appointments, and I felt like I was wearing a second skin, and there's this heaviness that you have because you're carrying around this person with you all the time. Like, it doesn't stop. It's different than, I'm a mother, so it's different than, like, momhood. It's different.
Sure. Well, this is a way for people to come and see your work this month with the first performance on Friday, August 13th. You did receive an Art Ventures grant from the Community Foundation of Northwest Florida, too, which is great. The performance is through the 21st of August. How can people get their tickets? And this is in the Cork Arts District, by the way.
It's Babs Lab, yeah, in the Cork Arts District. They can go to social media and look up Babs Lab, and the information there, or my Instacant, which is also Babs Lab at Cork Arts District. But and the ticket, you could go to barbacolacello.com. And I want people to know that it's going to be, you know, I'm only selling 20 to 30 tickets a night. It's limited. Mm-hmm. Mask wearing. We're asking people, you know, we're hoping people will be using the honor system and be vaccinated. I have to keep everyone safe. And we will also be videoing it. So I will be able also offer people to be able to see it virtually. But I need to get the work out there. And it's important to me because through my journey, I found out that caregivers are really at a risk of, if you're a caregiver, you have a 63% chance of, compared to a non-caregiver, to have 4 to 8 years taken off your life. People who take care of Alzheimer's and dementia patients.
And there's so many of
40%
them.
40% of them.
Yeah, there's so many of them out there. I'm sorry to cut you off. Check it out. It's Open Hearted, written and performed by Barbara Colicello. First performance Friday, August 13th at her Babs Lab in the Cork District. Thank you so much, and break a leg.
Thank you. And I want to say one last thing. It's funny. I know the topics are heavy.
I know. Heavy topic, but we need some laughs. So, yeah, so come out and laugh.
Yeah, no, it's definitely funny. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Barbara. Have fun, everyone, and be safe. And thanks for listening. Thanks also to producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, associate producer Catherine Hobbs, editorial director Jessica Palumbo, and digital editor Bill Bortsfield. Drop us a line. We love your feedback. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and catch our podcast up later today wherever you like to listen. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross. Mask up, get vaccinated, folks, and have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.